Soupy Sales died this week at the age of 83. He wasn't born with that name, of course, but Milton Soupman, the comedian who took on the name Soupy Sales, became a star of early children's television when the goal was to entertain, not teach much of anything, maybe how to throw a pie in your face. Bert Dubrow was a friend of Soupy Sales for many years. He's a TV producer who's been executive producer of the Jerry Springer Show, the Sally Jesse Raphael Show, other programs. He joins us from Los Angeles. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure under these not-so-terrific circumstances, but it's always a joy to talk about Soupy.
Did he ever estimate how many pies he'd taken in the face?
You know, I think he did, but I want to be honest with you. I don't remember, but I think he did. And whatever the estimate was, probably was wrong anyway.
Yeah. Is it true that he would slip in things for adults?
I don't think he did it intentionally. I don't think he ever considered himself really a children's performer. And it just happened that way, but Soupy was hip. And, you know, I would compare it today to the people that knew the Pee Wee Herman show when it came on. It had a little bit for kids, but it had a lot for adults. Soupy really invented that whole thing. I don't know that he knew he invented it, but he invented it.
Yeah. How happy was Soupy Sales with being Soupy Sales?
I think he was really happy being Soupy Sales. I don't think he was necessarily overly thrilled, as I said earlier, about being that kid's performer, but he got out of that. I mean, a lot of people didn't realize it. He became a very, very hot nightclub performer, and then he did What's My Line in syndication for years, and I think one of the reasons he did do it was to be able to put on a sport jacket and a tie, a regular tie, not a big bow tie, and show people that he was an adult performer, and his audience followed him right up there to that.
Yeah. Did he ever actually tell children to go get money out of their parents' drawers?
He did, but here's the story.
Okay, and nobody
ever tells the story right.
Yeah.
It was New Year's Day, and what he said was, listen, your parents are sleeping. They had a rough night. So just tiptoe into their bedrooms, go inside their purses or their pockets or their wallets, and get Soupy all those green pieces of paper. Now, that's where everybody ended the story, you see.
Yeah.
But the real payoff to the story was Soupy said, you send me all those green pieces of paper, and I'll send you a postcard from Puerto Rico. That was the joke, you see. But nobody remembers it that way, but that's what happened. And then he was brought into the manager's office of Channel 5 in New York, fired, I guess, or temporarily fired, if that's the right way to put it, and then there was picketing for weeks in front of 67th Street, Channel 5 in New York, and they had to put him on the air, and he became bigger than ever.
Well, I'm glad you're here to clear that up for us. Thanks so much, Bert.
No problem.
Bert Dubrow talking about his friend, Soupy Sales, who died this week at the age of 83. This is NPR News. We heard a story back in May about a legendary Utah explorer and writer who'd been missing for 75 years. The remains of Everett Roos were supposedly found and definitively identified with DNA testing, but doubts lingered, and this week the results of new DNA tests were released, and the mystery of Everett Roos is again a mystery, as NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Everett Roos was a 20-year-old idealist and vagabond when he disappeared in the rugged canyon country of southern Utah, leaving behind poems, letters, paintings, and block prints that celebrate the region's beauty and wildness.
Everyone that runs into his trail, you can't help but become fascinated by this young man and what he did.
Ken Sanders is a Utah bookseller who collects the writing and artwork of Everett Roos.
The mystery of what happened to him or who he was overwhelms his life and his legacy, and I think that the main thing is to not forget what this young man represented, his love and unbridled passion for untrammeled wilderness, just hedonistic love of the landscape.
This passion for Everett Roos engendered a cult following steeped in the mystery of his disappearance. Earlier this year, it seemed the mystery was solved. Skeletal remains, DNA testing, and a plausible story about murder meant Roos was lost no more. But new tests indicate he's still missing. Brian Roos is his nephew.
Well, I think we'd go back to where we were a year and a half ago, where we hope that someday he will be found. I mean, so you continue to live with the assumption that the mystery will never be solved, but the hope that it will.
Just a few months ago, the family was close to cremation, but state archaeologist Kevin Jones doubted the DNA tests. The remains had Native American features, so the family approached the DNA experts at the Defense Department and they determined with no doubt this was not Everett Roos. The University of Colorado lab that conducted the original testing now admits it made mistakes. Dr. Mike Coble directs the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory, and he says his staff has been touched by the Roos saga.
The scientist that did most of the lab work, she has pictures of Everett. She's been reading his work, and it is amazing how his writings are still very, very powerful.
So now there are two mysteries. Where is Everett Roos, and what life once flowed from the recovered bones? The DNA testing indicates this was a young Navajo, and the remains will now be turned over to the Navajo tribe. Roos left these final words, as read by bookseller Ken Sanders.
As to when I shall revisit civilization, it will not be soon. I prefer the saddle to the streetcar and the star-sprinkled sky to the roof, the obscure and difficult trail leading into the unknown, to any paved highway, and the deep peace of the wild to the discontent bred by cities.
So wrote Everett Roos in his final letter dated November 1934, before he and two burros disappeared into a sea of Utah sandstone. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
And listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Here's one of the best lines I've read this week. The only way the new jobless claims report could be more disturbing is if Bob Dylan sang it on his new Christmas album. That's a tweet from Bad Banana, who we've spoken to before on the show. We'd like to catch up with him to get a sense of what people are thinking, talking, laughing about on social media networks, including Twitter. Bad Banana, otherwise known as Tim Seidel, a creative director at a Greater Nebraska ad agency, joins us from his home in Lincoln. Tim, thanks very much for being back with us.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And I'm guessing, what, Balloon Boy, executive pay, healthcare debate?
Yes, and I would say Balloon Boy kind of dominated the early part of the week. And, of course, the end of last week when it unfolded live on television during the workday. Mm-hmm. Ray Adverb said, the sad thing is, now nobody will believe the thousands of families whose children really are trapped inside runaway balloons.
I had the same thought as I was watching that coverage. I really did. Anything on the release of Windows 7?
This week, Microsoft, as you know, released Windows 7, and MoDat had this to say, I set my Sleep Number bed to Windows 7. Now my bed has bugs and no support whatsoever.
I want to ask you about some of your tweets, which I enjoyed this week, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You talked about your Halloween costume.
Yeah, for Halloween, I'm going as Michael Jackson and Roman Polanski in a saucer balloon made out of healthcare bills and Rob Blagojevich hair.
Is it a fair generalization that the worse things get economically, people kind of seek refuge in certain kinds of humor?
I think that's absolutely true. I get notes all the time from people who say that sometimes a funny note on Twitter here or there is kind of the highlight of their day. I think people are trapped in front of computers. Mm-hmm. I think people are hearing gloomy news at night and seeing gloomy news on their computer screens during the day. And I think they're looking for reasons to smile.
Speaking of gloomy news, if you give credit to the Mayan calendar, the end of the world's at hand, isn't it?
Like I said earlier this week, screw the Mayan calendar. This Dilbert desk calendar speaks of nothing beyond December 31st, 2009.
You know, in your own tweets, Tim, you're even-handed politically. I must say I was struck by the sharpness of something you said about something to observe on Saturday.
Well, today,
which I think is a fair observation.
Well, believe it or not, today's a holiday.
Yeah.
And earlier this week I had this to say, Saturday is United Nations Day. I will celebrate by doing nothing.
Oh. I think the United Nations can take that kind of observation. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Tim Seidel, better known on Twitter as Bad Banana, speaking to us from his home in Lincoln, Nebraska. This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. One of the selling points for the new movie about Amelia Earhart is an uncanny resemblance. The film star, Hilary Swank, looks a lot like the real aviator. And that got Bob Mandela wondering, does it really matter if a biopic star resembles its subject?
Everyone knows what Lawrence of Arabia looks like. He looks like Peter O'Toole, just as Cleopatra looks like Elizabeth Taylor, and the King of Siam looks like Yul Brynner.
These are the children you shall teach. Someday shall allow you to meet my others.
More, Your Majesty?
Children of wives not in favor with King. 67, I think.
Any actual resemblance strictly irrelevant. So when the producers of Amelia bragged that their star looks so much like Amelia Earhart that they could use 1930s newsreel footage at one point rather than shooting a new scene, you think, well, cool, but so? It's lucky casting, certainly, but since when are filmmakers sticklers for authenticity? In TV's The Tudors, for instance, even this season's aging Henry VIII isn't the fat, goitered, thin-lipped king we know from his portraits. He's pouty and athletic with a crew cut. Easier on the eyes, presumably, as he's bedding those six wives. Or consider Julia Child. In this summer's Julie and Julia, the hair's right, but not the look. The real Julia was bubbly and flamboyant.
Welcome to the French Chef. I'm Julia Child.
So Meryl Streep captured the plummy voice.
I'm Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Streep didn't have to compete visually with a shot of the real Julia Child, but films about other famous figures have lately taken to actively bragging about how true to life they are. Audiences sat transfixed through the end credits of the movie Milk last year, as photos of the real people who'd worked with gay activist Harvey Milk were matched with the actors who'd played them, virtual twins, some 30 years later. And a similar impulse drove the makers of the new soccer rivalry movie, The Damned United. In this country, we don't know feuding coaches Brian Clough and Don Revie, but in Britain, they're downright legendary. And again, they're nearly twinned. We've got footage you can compare on the NPR website. But just as a sample, here's how Michael Sheen's Clough and Colm Meaney's Revie sound in the film when they're arguing on TV.
I'm a warm man, an idealist. I do believe in fairies, and that's my outlook. Don is slightly different. He's a cold person.
No, you don't know me.
And that lack of warmth, that coldness was there. It permeated the club when I arrived.
I totally refute that.
And here's the real coaches arguing on TV.
When I went in there, there was friction. There was unhappiness.
What do you mean, friction?
There was unhappiness because you'd gone an unsigned contract.
No.
Pretty close, Orally, and close in appearance and gesture as well. And you want downright genetic closeness? In the rap biography Notorious earlier this year, the late hip-hop artist Biggie Smalls was so precisely captured by actor Jamal Woolard that Smalls' own son was cast to play the rap star in childhood flashbacks.
With the mic in my hand, I know that you understand. Not a fool or a loser, I'm a woman.
W Wallace rappers are demolished.
Now, it's worth noting that dramatic effectiveness does not depend on visual accuracy, and in fact, may be undercut by it. If you're lucky enough to get handsome Johnny Depp for your gangster movie and then load him down with prosthetics to make him look like craggy John Dillinger, the audience is going to spend the whole movie cursing you and thinking about makeup. On the other hand, when you're handed not just a look-alike, but a look a whole lot alike, as with Hilary Swank and Amelia, why not take advantage? Just don't expect it to do too much of the dramatic work. As your parents no doubt told you, looks aren't everything. And as the film Amelia will tell you, looks will do nothing at all to brighten a dull script. I'm Bob Mondello.
And you can compare Hollywood stars with the famous people they've portrayed yourself. If you go to our website, you can check out side-by-side photos of the lookalikes. That's at npr.org.